So while this is loading, good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to present some work we did. I'm Crystal Sine from UNC, and I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors and our team who did this project. So this is Project SEED, is the acronym, and it stands for Screening and Education to Eliminate Disparities. So this is the larger project, and what I'm going to give you a little bit of background on that, but what I'm going to focus on today is the dissemination of this educational curriculum that really served as sort of the active component or the intervention here. I have no relationships to disclose. So as I said, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on Project SEED, and then I'll talk about the dissemination of the Power to Prevent curriculum. So as we all know, African Americans are disproportionately impacted by the diabetes epidemic. So they're twice as likely to have diabetes, they have worse diabetes control, and higher rates of complications than non-Hispanic whites. So this project was done in North Carolina. So I'm giving you a little bit of statistics for North Carolina as a whole, and then for the three counties in which this work took place. So you can see if you compare the counties to the state as a whole, there are a larger percentage of African Americans. The poverty rate is generally higher than the state average, and the diabetes death rate is higher. So the Diabetes Prevention Project was a large randomized clinical trial of close to 4,000 adults who were at high risk for diabetes. So this was funded by the NIH. There were about 45% racial and ethnic minorities, about 20% were African American. And this trial compared lifestyle modification or weight loss, eating a low-fat, low-calorie diet, and increased physical activity to medications for lowering diabetes risk. They followed people for about 3 years, and then the trial was stopped at 3 years because they saw an overwhelming benefit to lifestyle modification over medications. So this really proved that lifestyle modification was more efficacious at preventing diabetes than was medication. And as you can imagine, people were very excited about this, and there was an immediate push to translate the intervention into real-world community settings. So as a result, there was this collaborative between the National Diabetes Education Program, the CDC, and the NIH. They collaborated to develop this curriculum called the Power to Prevent curriculum. So this was based on this clinical trial findings, and it was designed to be implemented or used in African American communities. The curriculum consisted of about 12 60 to 90 minute interactive modules, which were focused on healthy eating and physical activity as ways to reduce diabetes risk. So although, you know, the curriculum had been informed by scientific evidence and it was shown to be efficacious in a clinical trial setting, we really didn't know how effective it would be in actual community settings. So we received funding from the North Carolina Health and Wellness Trust Fund, and this was a community academic partnership between a faith-based organization that was very active and well-established and that had a history of doing lots of work related to reducing racial and ethnic disparities in health, a community-based organization that was focused on nutritional approaches to chronic disease risk, a community-based consulting firm, and then physician researchers, myself and a colleague from UNC Chapel Hill. So the overall objectives of Project SEED were to increase knowledge about and screening for diabetes and cardiovascular disease, to increase implementation of lifestyle modification to minimize risk and to manage these diseases, and to increase the number of local community organizations and churches who implemented institutional policies to improve the health of their communities. So in this observational study, we recruited basically four groups of African American adults across three rural counties. So at Halifax County site, it was a church, again, with a very active health ministry. At Franklin County, it was a church that had not done as much health-related work, but was very interested in improving their health-related resources. And then in Wilson County, we worked with a nonprofit community-based organization that was devoted to serving socioeconomically disadvantaged persons through sort of multiple mechanisms. So we used a peer educator model in which we utilized experienced facilitators from the local communities to deliver this educational curriculum. Our measurement included a mixed qualitative quantitative design. So we performed descriptive analyses based on survey data and then conducted semi-structured individual interviews with the facilitators. We also measured pre- and post-curriculum changes in knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors related to physical activity and healthy eating, and measured baseline and six-month changes in blood pressure, glucose, or A1C if they were diabetic, and weight and BMI. So now I'm going to move into talking about the dissemination. So again, you know, this curriculum was based on strong scientific evidence and was designed to be used in communities, but we really didn't know if it had actually been used in communities, and if so, you know, what were people's experiences using the curriculum. Therefore, the aim of the study was to evaluate the dissemination process using a structured and well-established framework. So the REAIM framework, developed by Russell Glasgow, uses a socio-ecological or systems-based approach to evaluate the public health impact of an intervention along five dimensions: reach, effectiveness, adoption, implementation, and maintenance. So for reach, we wanted to know who actually participated. So for many of these slides, you'll see sort of the overall sample and then stratified by our different sites. So overall, there were 104 participants. The mean age was about 57, 75% were female, 46% were diabetic, and 71% of the non-diabetics were at high risk for diabetes. So then we asked, you know, what we looked at the participation rate. So out of 12 possible sessions, 43% of participants completed at least 75% of the sessions, 20% completed at least 50%, and then 20% also completed less than a quarter of the sessions. So for effectiveness, we asked the question, does the curriculum actually improve diabetes knowledge, based on a diabetes knowledge survey, which was 16 items, and in this, for these questions, you measure the average percent that are correct. So for the average score at baseline was 64% correct, and that increased to 80% at 6 months, and this was found to be statistically significant. The next question was whether or not the curriculum actually results in changes in participants' self-reported goals and expectations for diabetes prevention. And we found that there were no significant change in any of these parameters. However, there was a significant improvement in knowledge of the impact of healthy eating and physical activity on diabetes prevention. So for adoption, you want to know how many organizations actually participate. So what is the adoption in the broader community? So three organizations participated by helping with recruitment and by providing space to hold the sessions. 12 church pastors agreed to implement at least one institutional level change related to healthy eating or physical activity, and 6 of the 12 pastors are now offering healthier food options at church events and or exercise programs. So for implementation, we assess the extent to which all of the intended components of the intervention are provided to participants, or in other words, you know, what's the fidelity to the intervention. So we found that the facilitators did not actually administer the pre- and post-session questionnaires. So again, our main comparison is pre- and post-curriculum, so after comparing the baseline to after the last session. However, there were pre- and post each session that lets you get a sense of how people responded to that individual session. Those were not administered. And also the food and activity trackers, which really is the main tool for this curriculum, were not consistently utilized. However, all of the sites did use at least some of the optional components, including inviting chefs or dietitians or diabetes nurses to take part in some of their sessions. So in terms of implementation, we also wanted to know what factors facilitated participation. Again, this was based on qualitative individual interviews. So we identified three themes, and then I'm just going to tell you the themes and read a representative quote. First theme relates to the length of the classes and group size. So It was, and I should mention that all of the facilitators were African-American females, so that's the responder for each of these quotes. It was small enough that they don't feel overwhelmed. They had time to ask questions. The second theme related to understanding of the material. None of it was like PhD, and it wasn't kindergarten either. You know what I mean? It was a fine balance in between. The third theme related to the family focus. The curriculum talks about how to incorporate friends and family, and that is the key to success because we are individuals, but we are part of a system that is bigger than us. In terms of the barriers to participation, again, we identified three main themes. So the first one was related to schedules and transportation. A lot of the participants did not like to drive at night. They just don't like to be away at night. The second one was related to the food and activity trackers. That was one of the hardest parts for participants, keeping up with their homework. Third theme related to literacy issues. Low literacy was an issue. We had to read almost all surveys, which caused frustration for the folks that could read because they were having to wait for the others. In terms of maintenance, we looked at changes from baseline to 6 months in mean blood pressure, random blood glucose and mean weight. So for the overall sample, you see that the blood pressure decreased slightly between, or this would be considered clinically significant, between baseline and 6 months, and the weight decreased. However, this was not statistically significant either for the overall group, sort of between groups or within each site. The next question was whether or not the improvements in healthy behaviors were maintained at the end of the intervention. So participants self-reported highest level of physical activity in the past week increased, and this trended towards significance, but this, again, was not statistically significant. And the self-reported number of days per week of 30-plus minutes of physical activity did not increase. So as with all studies, our study has limitations. The dropout rates were high across all the sites. Therefore, this limited our statistical power for most of our analyses. And we also did not get participants' perspective on the program. So in conclusion, we found significant improvements in diabetes knowledge and the knowledge of the impact of healthy eating and physical activity on diabetes prevention. And some of the programmatic features, such as the class size and the ease of understanding of the material, providing transportation for participants and food at all the sessions, facilitated participation. However, low literacy was a major barrier to participation. And despite our best hopes, the program was not fully implemented as intended, so it really makes it hard to know, you know, what changes should you make or to be able to say, is this actually effective in communities? If it doesn't fully get implemented, it's very hard to then say. So I'd just like to acknowledge our funders and our key staff, both at UNC and out in the community. Happy to take questions.
So now we're going to have question and answers from between the audience and our speakers, and I hope that you will have asked questions. I know I have several myself. Again, I do want to take this opportunity to encourage you to attend our caucus business meeting tomorrow night. I also have at the front here a schedule of events here at APHA of all our public health and faith community caucus sessions, and I also have membership forms for you if you're interested. But now let's take some questions from the audience for our speakers, and let us ask the questions. I think the room is small enough to where we can hear without the mic. Does everybody think we can do that?
Yeah.
Because the reach, so those people are not coming into the church.
Yes, thank you for your
question. And yes, we tried to address that. One of the consultants for the study is a professor at the University of Puerto Rico and also at one of the theological, accredited theological seminaries on the island. They are in the works of trying to do a census of church attendance on the island. They did something similar, but right now it doesn't show what's happening. Even the references of 85% Protestant and a Catholic and 15% Protestant, I'm sorry, that data is from the CIA and it's not very recent. So that might have also shifted a little bit. But in terms of attendance, that's something that needs to be worked at. It's just the respect that the people still have for the church institution and they consider it. Plus, when we look at religious factors, public religiosity, which is what you're referring to in terms of attendance, we need to see, okay, are the regular members, are they active there? Are they just going, sitting in and leaving? Or are they just going for specific religious holidays? That's also something else that we'll need to consider for further study. So thank you.
Did you want to say something?
Well,
oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of just, for us, the emphasis has always been on outreach with no particular concern for the full interviews. And I don't say that in a callous manner, but the focus has been outreach. So our efforts have been toward the housing projects, the homeless shelters, the jails, and things like that. I think just the outreach effort has generated some inreach, and that some of the people who were not attending attend now just to see what's going on. But I need to tell you, there was a bit of contention too, because one of the hurdles that we had to climb over in the outreach effort was the traditional mentality of, we don't want those people coming in here, okay? And so now we have more of those people than we do any other person. So there's been a paradigm shift, but the focus is really on outreach. And so much so that I can tell you that we have to build a new facility, and the sanctuary part of it will be the least of it. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the space will go toward outreach and clinics and things like that. So it's really been a major shift, and I'm pretty excited about that.
Can I
say something else? You reminded me, so thank you. There was one of the pastors that participated, one of the religious leaders that participated, that made reference to some specific Bible verses and some specific quotes saying that it is the church's responsibility to go out, and that is something that they question themselves. Are we doing it? Are we reaching out to the community? And that's important. I mean, it's part of the reaching out to going in. And one of the participants even said, it doesn't mean that everybody's going to be a Christian, but we need to go out and serve them.
Okay, ma'am.
Sorry. My question is related to the diabetes prevention project. Part of the dissemination. The first question is, do you have a sense of how closely the dissemination model matched the actual research model? Because that was very, very intensive. It had professional coaches, and it, you know, to help people with lifestyle changes, and there were pretty frequent visits. So did the dissemination model have that kind of strategy or approach in it?
So let me just clarify, I think, what I'm hearing in your question. So are you asking me whether what we did out in the community, whether that matched the intensiveness of what they did in the trial? Or
yes.
Are you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So that's a great question. No, it didn't.
Okay.
It wasn't intended to, because this curriculum, again, after the trial, they kind of looked at what was done in the trial, what were all the things that we think are key, and then they scaled those down and they said, okay, here are the active ingredients, but let's put this in this curriculum, which, by the way, is free of charge. You can get it. It's a great tool if any of you are interested in doing this. But they, you know, clearly it wasn't motivation. They did a lot of stuff in the trial that we did not do in the community, because we followed the curriculum, which they had already done a lot of the pre-testing to say, okay, here's the sort of minimum that would closely match what the educational component was in the trial.
Do you have a sense of why people dropped out?
So that, you know, that's a great question. I do. I do have some sense. So I think, let me try to give a brief answer. So part of it, again, was one of our sites, again, was led by a very dynamic, charismatic pastor who was very involved
in the research endeavor. He's finishing up a PhD, but is extremely steeped in the community, but his church is well primed for this. So he has some dropout, but less than the other sites, again, because programmatic things. He tacked these classes on right before Bible study. So he had sort of a captive audience. He had a van that brought people to Bible study an hour and a half earlier. So those groups tended to stay in, whereas in some of our other sites, some of what we realized were, again, and these are some of the nuances, I guess, of doing, you know, CBPR work, but one of our other community partners who's done, you know, has an organization that's devoted to nutritional approaches, has also worked a lot with researchers and is involved in the community and have connections. But I think what we realized a little bit later after we started was that her level of her buy-in, we talk about other people's buy-in, but even sometimes among our partnerships, we don't necessarily get buy-in. And I think from the beginning, she was always a little, I don't want this to be research yet. She wanted it to be, you know, she was involved in the research piece. And so we found that she really undersold this. So she would tell when she was recruiting other organizations to be involved in this, she would tell them stuff like, well, just get people to come to a session or so. Well, this was never meant to drop in the set. This was meant to be a comprehensive 12-session curriculum. So we found a lot of people who might come one time, might have gotten a baseline assessment, never came back again, or came. So you're obviously going to get a lot of drop-in that way. And the other piece related to that is just, you know, the curriculum is 12 sessions. They suggest that you do one session a week for 6 weeks, and then maybe once a month, realizing that community people, when you're working in disadvantaged communities in particular, but any community, people are busy, have lots of other things going on. So we follow that model of weekly for 6 weeks and then monthly, and it ended up being not a good idea. And partly because our community partners said, people aren't going to do weekly. But it turns out at the end, they said, people would have stuck in longer had we done consecutive weekly, because you lose people once you bring it on monthly.
My question is in regards to the HIV outreach. That was very encouraging to hear about the number of people reached and that came in for testing. And my thought went immediately to linkage to care. And I'm wondering, because we know early intervention saves lives, and I was wondering if you have success in linkage to care to healthcare systems, and if so, how so, and how does it work?
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, we're linked to the local ASO, and what the church does is we do rapid testing, and so that's the 20-minute results kind of a deal. If that gives us a preliminary positive, then we will take the individual. We've got 5 case managers, so we do a lot of hand-holding. We do what we call direct referrals, and we don't say, okay, here, go see so-and-so. We'll take you to public health for confirmatory. That takes about 2 weeks. When the results come in, we'll take you back for those results. If they're positive, then we will link you to the local AIDS service organizations where you can then tap into the resources to get that. And then we'll do follow-up after that as well. But we also have support groups that allow them to stay in touch with us.
I have a question about the loans. You alluded to a couple of things. You said that you had a paradigm shift of your membership in the church that was more outreach.
Yes.
Focused. So was that due to growth of the church, or did you lose some of your membership that was more traditional? And secondly, I'm asking with that then, so how in having more people from the community in need as a part of your congregation, yet you say that the church and the Baptist denomination is often entrenched in judgment. So how did your church and you as the pastor, is that accepting? You know, is it one of that's a phrase used of love the sinner but hate the sin, or is it just a change in view of people's, you know, status that's more accepting in general?
Yeah. Okay. Now, what was the first part? The paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Yeah. tremendous fights. A lot of fights. We lost a lot of people. From a personal perspective, they tried to vote me out. There were some lawsuits. Got really nasty for about 3 years. The second part of it is just what we were doing, and we have curriculum for this as well. You have to actually teach pastors to preach sermons that are HIV centered, which are really people centered sermons. And I don't know about this hate the sin, love the sinner, or whatever you're saying. We all sin. And that's how I operate, you know. And it starts with me, and I'm not going to go to church on you, but Paul said, I'm a chief sinner amongst you. So that's my premise. So then I don't let them get away with their stuff. If I can't get away with mine, you can't get away with yours. So really, it does start from the pulpit, okay? And then the embracing. And I can tell you, there's a recovery month every fall, you know, addiction recovery and all of that stuff. And so I remember doing a special altar call for those in recovery. And two people came up, and my response was, well, what's wrong with the rest of them? Because everybody's in recovery from something. And so that's the paradigm shift, okay? It's just the mentality of how you do business. And it's all about outreach. It was never about sitting and doing what we do. It's all about outreach.
Yes, I work for the health department in the city of San Antonio in Chocolate Obesity. And we, as a health department, can try to influence policy change from the inside, but we can't, we actually can't tell our community partners to go speak to city council and that kind of thing. And it seems like that's a major opportunity for growth in the future in faith-based community is to get involved in the policy change. And I wonder what some of your thoughts may be toward that. Because at the end of the day, you know, we still have, whether the church is very integrated and has a strong community buy-in, we still have a lack of parks, we have a lack of shared streets.
Yeah, well, let me just say this. let me just say that. I'll hang around to take whatever questions you might have. I don't want to take anything away from my colleagues. You may want to. I'll be around, okay? But let me just say that it's all about policy change. We do have a very active, what we call, they name themselves Citizens Against Death. And so what we do is we do a lot of going to the city councils and making their voices heard. And right now is a really great time. One of the things that we do at the drop-in center is we register ex-offenders, and we talk a lot about policy. So we do those kinds of things, and we line those people up with where to go and who to talk to. So we're very active in that. I have to be careful because I wear a couple of hats, so I have conflicts of interest with the university and in my role as a pastor. But at the end of the day, then it's all about policy and implementation and those things. And I'll tell you one of the things that's prevalent right now, especially with HIV, is the money that's gone away. The Ryan Wright money is gone.
Yeah.
So you literally have to be dying now to get medication.
Right.
I mean, they'll put you on a waiting list. And so my strategy has been to simply say to people, when they ask me about money, to simply say, well, not enough people are dying. And then they're offended. Then you transfer that into something meaningful. You say, well, look, I'm going to the council meeting. You want to join me? So now you show up. Where I'm from, 200 people can swing an election. I mean, it's just a little small place in the Midwest. 200 people make a difference, and we let them know that. But that's also how we got the paradigm shift, was empowering the people that were there, as opposed to the established members who laid the first brick, as if that means something to say that, you know, we're all equal and everybody has a vote.
I was going to say, just wanted to add, the other thing, I'm also involved in a HIV-related project that we did for HIV prevention, primarily focused on adolescent. And I will challenge part of what you said in that, you know, we can't teach communities how to go to the city council. So I think part of that is we can teach them. So we have a we can teach them. And we have a PhD Kellogg community health scholar who finished her PhD who developed sort of an advocacy curriculum that we're actually teaching people in these communities, what do you do? And the other thing is, I think, you know, thinking about our partners more broadly, so on our community advisory board, and a very active part of it is the local representative to the House of Representatives, who's from one of these counties, who's extremely dynamic. So not only does she let us know and keep us abreast of what's going on in Congress, but what steps can we take, and, you know, just knowledge doesn't always change behavior, but it is powerful. So keeping us abreast of that and helping the community know how can I have a voice and hold our representatives, you know, accountable for what is done or not done.
The question is, the curriculum that you just mentioned around advocacy training, has that been tested?
They're actually testing it now. Yeah, it's been developed it last summer, has done, or this past summer, did the curriculum. So we're teaching youth as well as, you know, this is a sort of a network based for parents and, or youth and a parent figure. So teaching them the curriculum. So the results of the testing have not been published yet or aren't available, but that will be.
So that next thing was, when is the curriculum available? That's the question.
The curriculum is available. I'm not sure if, you know, we don't obviously have effectiveness level data on it, but, yeah.
This question is actually for Ms. Mercado, principal. Mm-hmm. I am so encouraged by your study. And one of the things that I know you talked about the process of developing your survey instrument, and I'm wondering whether or not you would make that available, because I can see an instrument like that also being interesting to look at it, specifically looking at African-American populations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking specifically kind of for myself. This is originally this is my home, even though I'm in North Carolina now.
Okay.
And the church that I attend, my mm-hmm. home church in this area, is in a low-wealth area of the city where we do have a lot of pre-adolescent classes, and where the church and other churches in the area would be really interesting to see
mm-hmm.
whether or not, or see if there are any parallels.
That's
between
right.
some of the information. So,
yeah.
I guess.
Absolutely. We can talk. Talk afterwards about that and about the instrument. This was a semi-structured interview, so it's pretty much a question guide
mm-hmm.
and a topic guide for the discussion. So there were other things that came up throughout the discussion because of the flexibility that qualitative research allows me for that. And as the participant was talking, I wanted to give the participant a voice. I think that's one of the things of the study that I think is very important, that they had a voice to express what they saw, what they thought, and their concerns. But we can certainly talk about that and ways that it can be adapted to your population as well. Certainly. Thank you.
This one has a capacity and a literature or brochures.
Do I have what?
The literature or brochures.
Brochures.
Not with me. I can give you the church's website where you'll find some of this stuff, and then I'll give you my university email, and I can send you anything you like. Some of the stuff we've had to modify, you know, when we first started, we really didn't have a specific curriculum for HIV and its implementation amongst African Americans, so we wrote one. So, but I'd be happy to share it.
Yeah.
I'm
going to
question. Anybody on lay supervised us the zucchini pasta? Thank you. I'm kind of curious as to if you have any inclination or thoughts on how well this your program would work in a African American church that's not Seventh-day Adventist. You know, my thoughts are, I go to a Pentecostal church and we are big among fellowship dinners, but there are never any zucchini pasta. That's my regulation. And oddly enough, I run the wellness ministry, and every month I present, you know, breast cancer or whatever it is. But we don't, you know, there is, hey, take the diabetes medication, but every time we have a dinner, the dinner mindset has yet to change, you know. So, I mean, they're making big chicken, but that's beyond. So I think, I don't know, the Seventh-day Adventists have some difference, but with respect to African-American churches where diabetes, heart disease are affecting us, it has to be more than just a shift of individuals, but a shift of the culture within the church, because I know Baptist friends, probably pastors can attest, we are really fried chicken, macaroni and cheese, and, you know, everything. So what are your thoughts?
I would have to say, I was surprised to find, because I'm not Seventh-day Adventist myself, I was surprised to find that they struggled with the same issues in the Seventh-day Adventist church as any other, even black church. I mean, it was, we went to their potlucks and we were like, whoa. So it was interesting to see their reactions, and whether or not they would embrace something so different was kind of a question mark. So
I'd be interested in your follow-up.
What's that?
I would be interested in your follow-up.
Right.
See, like, how long it could take. That's really good.
So, but I would say one more thing is the community gardens model for any church because they have property. And it was interesting because people wanted the garden not just for the health aspects, but for the fellowship and the outreach. And that's where it was a multi-purpose kind of project that I think could be replicated and could be of interest to other denominations as well.
Let me say one thing to that also. I think the other issue is, if we go back to everything that we've heard here today, is that if the pastor agrees that the bishop sets the agenda and says, we are going to, this is what says to whoever your kitchen committee is, this is what we are going to eat, then that is what will happen. The church that I went to out in Western Kentucky when I was in graduate school, we ate no pork, we had no cakes, dessert was fruit salad. I mean, and that's the way it was.
I say, I'll be at my house and assess that. And there was a decrease in attendance for fellowship
denomination specific. For example, I'm thinking of two drastic examples right now. One of them, they said, we group these churches and congregations, but each congregation, the pastor and the board are the ones who decide what's happening there. So we have no voice. We go into the legal aspects, maybe help with the property and some general guidelines, but we don't go specifically into what they do. On the other side, there was another one that said, right now we're pilot testing some relationships with the equivalent to the Administration of Children and Families to try to deal with the problem of child maltreatment and domestic violence in the families. And we have some churches that we're training some people, see how that goes. And then afterwards, the long-term goal is to have at least one person specialized and trained on that at each congregation. So it varies greatly by denomination, at least in Puerto Rico.
You have a question?
It's sort of on that same thing. In our church, we had the same issue, but what we backed up to do is to take the time, and it was a developmental process. People did not get where they were overnight, and we took the time to help them connect the food with their faith and their sacred scriptures. And so people are more motivated to make that change because it has meaning for them. It's connected to you being a Christian. I'm a Christian. So, Brenda's living the Christian life and what you're eating and how you care for your temple, taking the time to make those connections for people is a powerful way to move people to the next place, because dictatorship don't work.
And don't get me wrong, it wasn't dictatorship. It wasn't tie-in. It wasn't tie-in to the fact that you look around and you say from the pulpit, I'm overweight. The majority of us are overweight, and we are actually doing God a disservice by not being good stewards over what He has given us, being this temple.
Okay.
We have to make some very real changes. And one of those changes that is going to happen is that we don't need to have cake at every single meal. We don't need to have fried chicken. Why can't we have baked chicken?
But they call it leadership or not.
or lack thereof.
Well, let's thank each of our speakers today. We've got a great discussion.